You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Kat Rosenfield, and this is Feminine Chaos. I am here today with Hillary Kelly. Hillary, would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. So I'm Hillary. I'm a contributor at Vulture for New York Magazine, and I write primarily about books there. I also write a lot about TV and occasionally pop culture and where those things all intersect.
Yes, which is also quite similar to my beat at Vulture, so that's fun. Just a couple of Vulture contributors here, and we are going to be talking about books today, specifically about contemporary thrillers and sometimes the authors thereof. So the first topic, first up, Hillary wrote this great piece for Vulture, and the title is "The Villainous Bitch Has Become the Most Boring Trend in Literature," which is also the thesis of the piece. And Hillary, I'm just going to quote you from that article. It says, "What we've come to call domestic thrillers have become, by and large, stories about psychos in shitty marriages." And then it goes on later to describe these books as conceived entirely around the premise that women will read and share them with delight because the protagonists are naughty or downright psychopathic, and that this represents a new horizon in literature. So there is a picture of Rosamund Pike at the top of this piece playing Amy Dunn in Gone Girl. And I wanted to start by asking, is Gone Girl the novel that kicked off this trend?
I don't think it's the first novel it's definitely not the first novel that did this, but I think that Gone Girl, obviously reached just like epic proportions in the book world in terms of sales, in terms of reach, the fact that it was turned into a film, and like very quickly turned into a film, that the film became a blockbuster. I think that Gone Girl like had a magic something to it, and publishers saw that magic something and wanted to capitalize on it. And so, you know, when they saw, you know, these kinds of manuscripts come across their desk, I think that it went from being sort of like, oh, a niche idea that maybe gets published occasionally, to like the, yes, let's like flood the market with these books because this is what people want. So long answer, short answer, yes. Gone yeah, Girl. So
is Amy Dunn a villainous bitch?
Oh my God. For sure. She's the villainous bitch in an amazing way. I hope nothing that, you know, happened in that I wrote that nothing that I wrote in that piece gave off the impression that I didn't think that Gone Girl was like a very, very masterful book. I really have a lot of respect for Gillian Flynn. And I think that Gone Girl turned a lot of conventions upside down. And I think that, that some of the things that Amy Dunn does are insane. When we discover that she has pumped her own blood out and stored it so that she can throw it on the floor and make it look like she's been hurt when she's, you know, kidnapped. She's 100% a villainous bitch, but she's also fascinating. She's not like a cutout. She's not like a Disney Ursula or Wicked Witch or Wicked Stepmother. She has so many layers to her, and that's what makes this so interesting is that, first of all, Amy Dunn is somebody who you end up rooting for, even after you find out what she's done. You kind of want her to succeed. And she's also somebody who, you know, is, you can just keep unpeeling her and finding more and more underneath.
Mm-hmm. Right. The thing about Gone Girl that always struck me is that, you know, Amy Dunn is crazy and maybe a sociopath, but there's this kind of sense there that maybe like, you know, her marriage sort of made her that way, or she's, you know, doing this in response to her unique relationship with her husband, who's right. You know, horrible in his own way, although not obviously a sociopath.
Right, right. You find out, you can't figure out what makes her so awful. And no matter how many times you read it, there isn't one answer. And that's just the mark of a really, you know, well-created character, that you can't figure out just one moment that turned them good or bad or anything in between. You know, you can blame Amy Dunn's parents for turning her into this like pretty princess on the covers of their books that they wrote about her life. You know, you can blame her husband. You can blame the magazine industry who, you know, lays them both off and gets them sent out to the Midwest. So,
Right. So she's not one dimensional. Would you say that the villainous bitch, like the, you know, sort of loathsome, trendy villainous bitch, is she sort of a one dimensional character?
Too often, yes. Mm-hmm. Not always. You know, I kind of judge what's going on in publishing by walking into Barnes & Noble and seeing what's happening on all those big wooden tables. Mm-hmm. Which very scientifically, but you can sort of see there, like the biggest, still, you know, the biggest brick and mortar book outlet in the country, even though it's shrinking and shrinking. You can see what they put out. They want, these are the titles that they think people's eyes are going to go to, right? And that people are going to respond to and pick up off the table and buy. Mm-hmm. And they are covered in books like this that are almost always about women who are in unhappy marriages or destructive marriages or painful marriages or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. And some of them are fascinating and layered. I think, you know, all of Gillian Flynn's other books sort of speak to this. She continually creates women who you sort of hate and also sort of love. But there are just so many books out there that, you know, the woman who did this or the girl who did that or the, you know, that are just, they're sort of painful because you can understand where they came from and you can understand the intentions. And they're not, I don't think that they're, you know, written by people who have any poor intentions of, you know, flooding the market, but this is what publishers do. They find a trend and they don't want to risk their money on unknown things. So they risk their money on knowing that they can get a blurb that says, you know, the new Gone Girl, the Gone Girl, right, of 2019, you know, the woman in Cabin 10 of 2019, the whatever. And they know that that helps sell books, and so they do it. Publishing needs money. I don't blame them necessarily, but, you know, some of the books are crap. Right.
So you talk about Leila Slimani in this, mm-hmm, piece, and I was wondering, was there one, you talk about kind of the trend and noticing that this is happening on the tables, but was there one particular book that kind of sent you over the edge into wanting to write this particular take?
I mean, it actually was this book. It was the Leila Slimani book.
Mm-hmm. Which is called Adele, I think.
It's called Adele. In French, it has a different name that is something about, I think it's called like The Ogre in the Garden. It has a very different name from French. It was actually her first novel that she ever had published. I think it came out in 2014. And then soon after that, she published The Nanny, which, you know, was on the New York Times top 10 books of last year. Received a lot of praise, and I thought was really, really smartly written and deeply disturbing on a like very fundamental level. I'm a mom, and I have a nanny, and reading a book about a nanny who, I'm not giving anything away. The first line is, right, that the kids are dead, that the nanny murders these children. It's a ripe topic. It's fascinating. It's disturbing. It's all of those things. And I had such high hopes. I was so excited to read Adele, which is about this woman who, named Adele, who is trapped in this sort of loveless marriage, or love light marriage. And she embarks on a series of affairs that are dull and uninteresting. I mean, to her, to the reader, I can't imagine that they were that interesting to Slimani when she wrote it. I mean, it very much seemed like a, she came up with an idea like, oh, people will be fascinated by a woman who has a lot of sex, and then tried to assemble a novel around that rather than coming up with a character who was compelling and then, you know, building her out.
Right. It's interesting that this was her first novel, and I have read Perfect Nanny, and I really liked it. I have not read Adele, and I guess, you know, now I'm probably not going to, because it you compared the sex scenes in the book to watching a Chia Pet commercial, which is, you know, basically, I think, about as damning a criticism as you can get. So, you know.
I feel a little bad for the Chia Pets over that, but I mean, yeah.
A slander on the noble Chia Pet, really.
A commercial staple of my childhood, by the way. I mean, like, those are just like formative television experience.
Right.
So, yeah.
this book, Adele, was kind of like, was it sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back?
It's interesting that
this is from 2014. So this would actually have been right in the flush of everyone kind of trying to get on, you know, to do their own riff on Gone Girl. And then it took another several years for her to produce The Perfect Fanny, which is really not one of these books. You have this complex and, pretty mysterious character at the center where you sort of understand why she did it. It's not surprising that she did it, but you still don't really know what makes her tick as a person.
Right. And that's part of her problem, that the nanny in The Perfect Nanny, is that nobody really cares about what makes her tick. And you can see that getting to her over time as the novel goes on, that there's this she sees them as this, like, at first this perfect family, who have everything that they want. They have a beautiful apartment, they have fascinating jobs, the children are adorable and pleasant and all those things. And she sees herself as putting in so much work and so much effort to keep this family happy. And she basically becomes the family glue. And yet nobody in the family seems to care about the shitty apartment she goes back to, or about her own child, or, it's a really strong indictment of, the way that we treat people who we hire to work for us, who we like bring into our homes and, seemingly talk to every day and never get to know. That book was really exciting, and that's why I had such high hopes.
Yeah. It's fascinating that the lack of curiosity about this woman's life is what ultimately, kind of causes her to go over the edge. And then by the time that you are ready to wonder about her, it's already too late. She's already done this terrible thing. And then you don't get the satisfaction of finding out. The more I think about it, the more that book is really artfully constructed.
It is. There's this amazing scene in it that I like have never stopped thinking about every time I've eaten a chicken. I don't know if you remember this scene, but the mother comes home and the nanny has, there's a chicken carcass, like picked entirely clean and washed with dishwashing soap. And it's sitting on the counter. And the mother's like, she recognizes this as an act of aggression because she told the nanny not to let the kids eat the rest of this chicken. And she threw it out. And so she knows that the nanny went in the trash, took it out, probably fed it to the kids and like shined it and left it there for her. And it's so weird and bizarre that you're sort of like, why didn't she fire her at this moment? But you're like, can you fire somebody for leaving a clean chicken on your, like,
we're going to have to return to this because I feel like this actually kind of connects in a certain way to something we're going to discuss later.
Okay.
We're going to put a pin in the chicken.
Yeah.
So the one thing that did occur to me as I was reading your piece, and thinking about how, these characters were made to kind of, like you said, they're supposed to be sort of an easy sell, like, ooh, she's so bad. Like, I love it. Let's read this book. But I started kind of wondering, like, are we overthinking this at all? Like, are these characters poorly written in a way that's actually unique? Or is this something that's like an effect of everyone kind of reading through a feminist lens now? Like, are we scrutinizing female characters more? Are these characters badly written in a worse way than, like, the hard-boiled detective in any, like, genre thriller?
Yeah, no, it's a very valid question. I mean, there are so many problems with the representation of women in literature throughout time. We could have like a 6-hour podcast about that. I think the thing that frustrates me in this case, though, is that there are so many wonderfully written women in literature, even terrible women, and especially terrible women. I love reading about terrible women. Like, nothing delights me more than finding new ways for people to be bad people. And that's why so much of my essay is about Madame Bovary and Flaubert, because, not to get too, esoteric, but, Flaubert really wrote sort of the first naughty woman, and made her very compelling. And so I think what frustrates me is that there's such a rich history of these kinds of women in literature that we could draw on, or that these novelists could draw on, that the publishers could look for. And instead, I feel like we're being sold such a watered down version of what these women could be. Like, there are always going to be worse issues dealing with women in literature. Everything, you know, from who gets published, who gets reviewed. I mean, there's always going to be a bigger fish to fry somewhere. Mm-hmm. But these are the books that are reaching most people's eyes. And so I do feel like there's a duty to make sure that this is representative of not just good writing, but, you know, actual women, and not sort of they become fetish objects of like, look how crazy we can make this woman. Like, mm-hmm. we can make her do just completely bonkers things that are not representational of what, you know, even 0.001% of women might do out there. But now it's starting to seem like every woman is like that, because that's what all of these books have to say. I mentioned in the piece, this new book by a writer named Laura Sims called Looker. And it's about a woman who has just been left by her husband. And she is very bitter that he's gone. And she becomes obsessed with this famous actress who lives on her block. And she starts to do just totally inappropriate things. And there's just this moment in the middle of the book where she murders her own cat. And I know I'm giving it away, but it's like, I felt a little bit like someone pushed this novelist and was like, this is where she's got to do something awful. I don't care if it's out of character. Find the weirdest, most awful thing you can think of and have her do it. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, I'll have her kill her cat. Like, smother it under a pillow, even though she loves it. Like, it's starting to feel like a little bit offensive that this is what we're supposed to want to know about women.
Right. Well, you know, it occurs to me that there was all of that backlash. I feel like it was maybe 5 years ago. Someone in an interview asked, and I don't remember the author's name, but I think you referenced this in your piece, actually.
Claire Massoud.
So it's like, you know, why isn't your female character more likable? And she went off on this rant about how, like, would you want to have a beer with Humbert Humbert? Like, why do female characters have to be likable? But, that, you know, perhaps now what we're doing is pushing it so far towards making them dislikable. It's like, look how terrible we can make this woman, and you're still going to read about her.
Right.
And you're going to like it.
And I absolutely. I mean, what Claire Massoud had to say and the conversation that came out of that was really fruitful and really interesting. I happened to love the book that conversation was focused around. It was called The Woman Upstairs. And it was Claire Massoud's a great writer. It was a fantastic, you know, look at the sort of spinster in the attic in a contemporary setting. Mm-hmm. And that conversation was great. And I'm glad if that pushed novelists to write about more unlikable women. I hope it did. And I hope we can sort of change the idea of unlikable too. And think like maybe the things we think are unlikable about women are just things that we only don't tolerate in women, you know, for mm-hmm. some reason. But I think that it has gone, that pendulum has pushed so far in the opposite direction. And what's sort of particularly like really gets to me is that these stories are almost always somehow based around these women's relationships with their partners, husbands, or ex-husbands, as if the marriage at the center has to be crumbling and these women only live in reaction to their spouses. These aren't independent actions, you know, based on their characters. They are about women who are having mostly like man problems. Mm-hmm. And there is already a very long and storied history of women in literature turning, you know, hysterical, use the word, over what men do to them, which is, you know, a valid topic. It's something that happens in the world, but it's not the only topic. And it's not the only reason that women might, you know, go off in an unforeseen direction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, so I think that we can segue here. Gone Girl, in addition to giving us the villainous bitch, also gave us the unreliable narrator. Not that it invented the unreliable narrator, but introduced this as a major trend in contemporary thrillers. It's how you ended up with, like, The Girl on the Train and The Silent Wife and all of these other. And this is how I'm going to, like, gracefully slide on in to topic number two, which is Daniel Mallory and The Woman in the Window. And Daniel Mallory, for anybody not in the know, is the author of this book, The Woman in the Window, which he wrote under the pseudonym A.J. Finn. And this book was kind of the big thriller of 2018. It sold at auction for like a gajillion dollars, and it was an instant number one New York Times bestseller and was being made into a movie before it even hit shelves. And the thing that was interesting about this book is that it was like genetically engineered to be a massive hit.
Right.
And that's in part because the author was also an editor and really had, you know, whatever his other flaws, which we're going to get to in a second, had this really kind of intuitive sense for what would make one of these contemporary thrillers compulsively readable, compulsively sellable. But as it turns out, its author is also kind of a character in and of himself. And there was a story in The New Yorker on February 4th by Ian Parker, absolutely bonkers piece of investigative reporting. And everyone should read it because it's fascinating and really, really long. But I'm going to try to sum it up. Basically, it seems like Daniel Mallory is a pathological liar who has, you know, serious mental health problems and managed to climb the ranks in publishing by fabricating, you know, sob stories about his life, claiming to have degrees he'd never earned, claiming to have cancer or a brain tumor, and also fabricated the deaths of multiple family members. Like, I think he basically killed off his entire family in the form of telling lies over the years, multiple times, in order to gain sympathy and all, you know. But even at a point where, like, people no longer believed him, he just kind of continued to do it for, you know, personal reasons. And then there was all this added weirdness, like, did he leave cups of urine around his boss's office to mark his territory when he was on the verge of leaving? So, yeah, absolutely bonkers, bonkers story. So, Hillary, we're both in the literary sphere. Was this story a surprise to you, or did it line up with anything you had previously heard?
I had not heard anything. I live in DC and I try actually my hardest to keep out of the New York literary scene, mostly because I'm a homebody and I don't like leaving my house at night. So I don't, like, don't invite me to parties because I don't want to go. So I didn't know anything about it. It turns out a lot of people and a lot of the people who Ian Parker talked to for this piece had known of this, had heard of this, and it had been sort of bubbling for years. In fact, one of the really interesting points that he makes in the piece is that when Woman in the Window came up at auction, the author's identity was withheld until a certain point. And when the author's identity came out, a ton of publishing houses dropped out suddenly. And the house that ended up winning and publishing Woman in the Window is William Morrow, who is the publishing house that Dan Mallory also worked for. But other publishing houses who he had worked for in the past, when they discovered he was the author, it seems like they didn't want anything to do with it. He disputes this fact and says that this did not happen, but Parker's reporting bears it out pretty firmly. So a lot of people, including some people I know who have now told me, like, oh yeah, I've heard all about this guy, did know that it was going on.
Yeah. So for me, I also do not live in New York City. I live in Connecticut. I used to work in publishing back at the very start. It was my first job out of college. So that was a long time ago. But I had heard whispers surrounding this book that he had maybe, and it's still just a rumor. I want to be super clear about this. I'm just gossiping. Mm-hmm. That he had stolen the idea or the manuscript or some combination thereof from one of his female authors, in exchange for kind of kicking back cash to her after the sale. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to see that not mentioned in the piece at all. It's still just a rumor amongst people in the publishing world. But yeah, it was fascinating to see. And when you were talking about how everybody kind of knew about this, it reminded me of Louis C.K., who frequently comes up on this podcast. We always seem to end up coming back to him. So let's just mention him again. It was like an open secret for years. Right. He had been like showing his dick to women, and now it turns out like Dan Mallory fabricating cancer and other things turns out also was something that people knew about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I didn't know about it. And when I opened up that piece, which is quite long, but in the best possible way, and it just sort of keeps snowballing and snowballing into a wilder story than you thought it could possibly be, I was riveted by it. I mean, first of all, I think it's a phenomenal piece of reporting. You know, it's obvious that Ian Parker spent a few months, if not longer, reporting this out, and he got some really great reactions from people who Dan Mallory has allegedly duped. I mean, these are the people, the actual people who have been fooled by him or been who have worked with him. You know, it was just bizarre how much it turned into a meta narrative as well. That Mallory, you know, had done all of these things, and then he had been the editor for Sophie Hannah, who's an incredibly popular novelist, and that she then used some very similar plot lines in her own books. It's unclear how much she knew about Dan Mallory.
She claims that it's a coincidence, and it's sort of left open to you, do you believe this or not, but it's sort of strongly implied that she's maybe not telling the truth.
Right, and she used these plot lines in thrillers. She's sort of the heiress to the Agatha Christie series.
Right,
and
she's
been writing some Agatha Christie novels. And I mean, it's all just so wrapped up in itself that you kind of can't find the center. It's like, you know, it just sort of keeps unfolding.
Yeah. So when we talked about the chicken carcass before, it was like, you know, it's like you conceive this as an act of aggression, but it's also so incredibly weird. That, you know, it's like, why doesn't she do anything about it? Well, you know, like, do you want to be the person to say, hey, like, it appears that you have washed and polished and left a chicken carcass in my kitchen to, you know, to intimidate me in some way? Like, how awkward is that conversation going to be?
Right.
And I started thinking about that when I was reading this Dan Mallory story. The book that I originally kept thinking about was Roald Dahl's Matilda. There's this point where the Trunchbull, I hope that everybody watching has read this story or is familiar with it. The villainous Trunchbull, the villainous headmistress, takes the girl by the braids and throws her over a wall. And, you know, because this is a fictional narrative, the girl does not die. But Matilda, the heroine, says that this is the Trunchbull's great secret, that you never do anything by halves. You go absolutely as crazy as you possibly can. So that in this case, you know, if a child goes and tells their parents what you did, they'll never believe you. But it also strikes me that, you know, being willing to do something really bonkers, and in Dan Mallory's case, the really bonkers thing is like leaving cups of urine around your boss's office. You know, that everyone assumes that he did this because there were cups of urine and then he left and there were no more cups of urine.
Right.
That, you know, when you're willing to do something like this that violates boundaries so completely, you can create this kind of bubble of protection for yourself because nobody wants to confront you about it. Nobody wants to be the person who comes to you and says, hey, did you pee in a cup and leave it in our workplace? Who wants to have that conversation?
Right. I mean, we once had someone, I worked at the New Republic a long time ago, and we once had someone who was just stealing food from the refrigerator, and nobody in the office could bring themselves to confront the person who we all thought was doing it, because it was just like, it was easier to just let it go. I mean, these are obviously things on very different levels. Urine in a cup, pretending you have cancer, which he's accused of doing, very different levels. But, you know, I think that the reactions that some of the people had in Ian Parker's piece really drove that point home, where, you know, some people were astonished that they were being contacted about this. They were sort of like, how could this be? This story was so horrific. I'm thinking particularly of the Oxford Don, I think it was Oxford, who had looked at Dan's application and his adjoining essay, which had said that, you know, not only had his mother had cancer and died, but he too had cancer. And then at some point the Don says, like, I think the dad was dead in the essay too. Like, he says, like, I'm 99% sure. And then he's sort of like, how could somebody, of course I believed it. Who would lie about such a thing?
Right.
And that's, I think that's sort of a layer of protection, like you said. But I think the other big layer of protection, which Parker lays out really well, is that Dan Mallory is good looking, charming, white, mm-hmm. and a man. And he has created, it seems, a cult of personality around himself, that he, you know, loves to talk. He's a big conversationalist. He loves to, like, reveal things about himself. And that is all too frequently the kind of person who nobody wants to confront. The white guy who's good looking and puts a great face on publishing and puts a great face on his own novels. And I mean, just the fact that he's so good looking, it's mentioned over and over in the piece. And a lot of people that I saw on Twitter were kind of upset that they were like, oh, we're glorifying him, making this like a cult of Dan Mallory. And I had the opposite reaction. I mean, I felt very much, not only that this piece really damned him, but that Parker was making a really good point by saying over and over how many people found him attractive. And it was like an indictment of how we all let behaviors like this slide in yeah. certain kinds of people, in attractive people.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, you can actually draw all kinds of lines between this and Ted Bundy, who mm-hmm. also, you know, got away with literal murder
right.
In many ways, because he was really good looking and he was charming and people wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And you know, it was interesting. I saw a lot of this reaction with people citing primarily that he was a white man. It was like, oh, this is how, you know, this is such a story about white male mediocrity being rewarded, you know, in the publishing industry. And that struck me as not entirely accurate. When I started thinking about, like, all of the guys, you know, the white men that I knew working in publishing, I started thinking, like, do I know anyone who could have gotten away with doing this? And the answer was no. I mean, first of all, like, most of them would never have tried. But then, you know, even if one of them had tried, I don't think that any of them were charming enough or, you know, generically attractive enough to earn that kind of position of trust, you know, to make people want to, you know, to please them and not confront them. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like, again, like the pee cups, you know, I mean, had I left cups of pee around the office, I'm pretty sure someone would have confronted me about it. I would never have been charming enough to get away with that.
Right. I mean, I think that what people who think that this is a glorification of Dan Mallory or of white men in general are missing is that a lot of this piece is a very subtle indictment of everyone who continued to prop him up. His publishing house released a statement, I believe, the next day or 2 days later, and they said that they're going to keep him as a client and that they don't comment on the personal lives of their writers, which I found astounding, because if this had just been a personal life issue, I don't think the New Yorker would have run the piece. This was a professional about him working his way through publishing, the lies he allegedly told to get a better job, you know, lying about his resume, saying he was an editor on Tina Fey's book, which turns out wasn't true.
Bullshit.
Saying that he, like, massaged some great movie into completion and, you know, all of these things that, you know, helped him get to where he was. And they said, we're still going to put out the paperback. And we haven't canceled any plans. I haven't heard anything about the film. I mean, if you want to be pissed at somebody, don't be pissed at Ian Parker for publishing this phenomenal story. Be pissed at the people who are still just going to keep giving Dan Mallory money and let him, he has a second book in his contract,
right?
Which apparently still plans to release. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think we should be in the business of policing writers' personal lives. If he had told a girlfriend that his family had died and they hadn't, I'd be like, well, that's weird. I mean, she should break up with him, but like, okay, that's what happened. This is very much a professional story and about, I mean, not just the pee, but like almost all of this story takes place within the bounds of the publishing world and how he was, you know, sort of passed from house to house with, you know, not a ton, it seems, of background check on.
Right. It was like he would kind of escape whenever it was getting, you know, he was getting close to being unmasked.
Right.
And then there was a point at which he like invented that he was having some kind of spinal surgery.
Right.
Then invented this, well, I mean, he actually does have a brother, but, you know, was sending emails as his brother. Clearly the brother himself was not writing these emails. And then later claimed that the brother had died.
Oh, that he had taken his life
and committed suicide.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say the thing that I found, I mean, not funny, like, well, a little funny, is he has two older sisters who apparently, though, they get off scot-free. I mean, I don't know what wonderful thing they've done for him, but he has two older sisters in real life, and he never killed them off. Like, I don't know what, I don't know what his parents and brother, what he thinks that they did to him or what. I mean, I don't know genuinely what would lead someone to do something like this. Parker makes a very good point of saying that, you know, Dan Mallory's defense is that he has bipolar disorder and he doesn't even have a memory of everything that happened over the past few years and that it has contributed to his strange behavior and et cetera. Parker says, you know, experts say this is not the kind of thing that somebody with bipolar disorder does. I mean, that's really upsetting, too, to take on a mantle of mental illness. Like there are a lot of people out there struggling with bipolar disorder who are not behaving like this and are not sort of cashing in on their mental illness for a paycheck, a big paycheck. Yeah. I mean, he owns a department in Chelsea, so.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, the thing that was kind of interesting to me is you were talking about like, you know, that his publisher is standing by him and, you know, they're going to still release his book. And I mean, obviously, you know, this is not something that they're doing in the absence of a profit themselves. It's not just that you know, he's going to make money. He's going to make money for them. But we are in an interesting moment where when I look at something like, the Jezebel piece about Jack Smith, which I don't know if you read, but that was a case of somebody being outed as literally just like a jerk in his personal life. But he ended up losing his job. And it's been kind of the question, like, did this happen because his persona as kind of a woke progressive dude was so tied into that professional life that when it turned out that he actually wasn't really a great guy to women, was it too damaging to his professional reputation for him to continue doing the job he was doing? But yeah, you know, the existence of social media as a tool for kind of exposing, people in this way has definitely, and you know, the kind of blurring of private and public lives has created this interesting moment where, you know, people are having to account professionally for bad things they've done in their personal lives.
Right. I mean, and I should be 100% upfront. My former boss is one of the men who lost his job as a result of reporting that uncovered a lot of inappropriate behavior that had taken place. I was a victim of some of that behavior. I was one of the people who spoke to reporters about what had happened. I 100% believe that there are men who should not be in positions of power over anyone, especially young women, because they have proven themselves just unable to keep it in their pants in the office. Literally, proverbially, whatever the case may be. But there is also a line, I'm trying to say this very carefully, there is also a line that has not been drawn firmly enough, where unfounded accusations of all kinds of things, I'm not just talking about sexually inappropriate behavior, but all kinds of things, rise up. Like there's a reason that the reporting system is in place at newspapers, right? That things are fact-checked and corroborated, why certain papers don't run certain stories. And I think that professionals do their jobs really well, and we should let them do their jobs. And it can become very, very dangerous. I'm thinking of your YA piece. Very, very dangerous when Twitter crowds form and decide to turn on someone based on information that they don't have a grasp of, that they haven't seen themselves. It's scary. I mean, it's scary because, you know, sometimes it's based on nothing.
And just on just rumor. It's like stuff written on a bathroom wall. Right. I should add that the YA piece is something, in case anybody's wondering why we're not talking about it right now, because I'm saving it to talk about with Phoebe when she returns for our next episode.
But
you're all very excited. My usual co-host has been on maternity leave, so
I will be interested to watch that one. I have enjoyed watching this play out, and it's not enjoyed. I've been fascinated by it.
Yeah,
there's nothing to enjoy. Yeah.
But of course, the Dan Mallory piece that we're discussing is an example of something that was impeccably reported and thoroughly reported over the course of obviously, you know, many months. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, an interesting takeaway from the piece and sort of where I end up when I think about it is what it illustrates. And I think this is something that is maybe speaks to what makes Mallory such an effective thriller and suspense writer, is that you can get away with so much if you are one of the few people who's willing to violate a social contract. You know, that we have all of these expectations in place for the people that we interact with. We all assume that we're telling the truth. And, you know, without that kind of fundamental trust, society just falls apart. So of course, like, you know, when somebody tells you something about themselves, tells you that their parents are dead or that they've struggled with an illness, like, of course you're going to believe them. Mm-hmm. But that it also goes this step further, and this is, sorry, we got a situation here.
Oh, no, rescue.
that this is, you know, the case, seems like a through line for a lot of liars and scammers and sort of serial fabulists, that even once you reach the point where you've told so many lies and so many outrageous lies that people no longer believe you, there's still this whole gray area that you can operate in where people are just doubtful enough, and, you know, and are just afraid enough of making things awkward and accusing you of doing something terrible that even though they don't believe you, they'll never say anything. Right. And that they can, you know, if you're willing to just, you know, throw normalcy out the window, you can operate in that space for a really, really long time and, you know, and to great success in some cases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I found very sad, and truly very sad and very interesting was that at a point in the piece, Ian Parker goes and tries to talk to Dan Mallory's parents. Mm-hmm. And his mother doesn't want to comment, which I completely understand. But his father sort of talks to Ian for a little bit. And he says, like, he's just a really great kid. And he sort of shows us some of the, like, small bits of truth lingering underneath this story that Dan's mother did have cancer, but she recovered. And that his parents were split up briefly and then got back together. And you can sort of see that, like, he's been rewarded for operating in this gray system, right? He's gotten raises. He's gotten fantastic jobs. He's gotten a huge book contract. I mean, it's in the seven figures.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the in the system that has stepped in to say to him, like, wait a second, this is not going to fly. Like, we need to, like, slow down or rethink what's happening. And I mean, there is a lot in the air. We were talking about Ted Bundy. We were talking about, you know, these novels that we were talking about at the beginning. There's a lot in the air about why are we so fascinated by scammers and grifters. Thinking of that piece about Anna Delvey, the woman who basically pretended to be an heiress, that also ran in New York Magazine. And I think that we are fascinated by people who get away with the wildest version of what we imagine we could be, you know, that, and this is sort of why a lot of people in the publishing industry are fascinated by Dan Mallory, because it's like, oh, if my story was just turned up a little, and that's what these novels are, right? They're these stories about people like this, liars, scammers, you know, the, you know, frustrated people who are trapped in families that they don't want to be in, max, like turning everything up to 11. Mm-hmm. And that's why we love these. That's why we buy these novels. That's why we read these stories by Ian Parker and other people. That's why we, I mean, it, we can't deny that it's alluring. You know, it's a version of humanity that we're terrified by, but that we're also like, oh.
Yeah. Fascinated by.
Right.
So, and it makes for great fiction. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of hope that you'll never encounter it in real life.
Exactly.
Well, I think that this is a, you know, we've kind of come so perfectly full circle, and you know, we've got the cat appearance out of the way.
Yeah.
So I think that we should end it here. Hillary Kelly, thank you so much for joining me.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kat.
So I'm just gonna cut that there.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits of Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.